Hello. We're going to be hearing a lot about black and white, so let me off the top say something about our Hispanic colleagues who on the past May 1st, May Day, came out of the shadows and into the streets to reclaim the real Labor Day for all American working people. This rainbow is much more than two colors, even if tonight we dwell especially on those two. I think the subject of the evening is twofold. The first objective is to revive and restart the movement in Western Pennsylvania in support of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And something was said about jam-packed rooms. Look around you. I think that rebuilding, that restarting is occurring. But beyond that, there's a second objective, which I suppose arises from conversations that several of us have been having with Mumia. And that second objective is, how do we recreate an interracial movement for fundamental change, for revolutionary change in these United States? There are many components of a new movement represented even in this room. My colleague in legal advocacy, Professor Jules Lobel, is vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, the principal advocate for the detainees in Guantanamo, and the principal organization responsible for last summer's great victory in Hamdan. Thanks to the Congress of the United States, we now need another great victory, Jules, to save the writ of habeas corpus, and we know you're there. I see Charlie McAllister, whom I've known since the late 1960s, and with whom I struggled first in Youngstown and then in Pittsburgh to save the steel mills of this region. We have important building blocks for a new movement, but certain building blocks we do not yet have. I don't believe we have yet, although I see it in this room, the black-white cooperation that is absolutely necessary to change our latter-day Rome, our imperialist heartland. We all know that, but we've had difficulty bringing it into being. I can recall in 1966 and 1967, after Stokely Carmichael and others had enunciated the idea of black power, it being said to me by co-workers in the civil rights movement, African-American co-workers, well, Staunton, for just a few years now, we're going to be working black on black. We want you to go and do something with those white working class honkies. And then after just a couple years, we'll get it back together and really change this country. And I'm not blaming any particular person, but it's 40 years now. Some of us are grayer than we were back then. And I think we need to find a way to recreate the kind of trust that did exist between blacks and whites for a period of years in the South in the 60s. And I'm not going to be as much concerned with evaluating the life of John Brown. I think Mumia may have more to say about that. As I am going to be concerned about what can we learn from the experiences of interracial cooperation in the movement for change at certain points in the past, which can help us to produce our new version as soon as possible. And let me begin by reading two lists. I think before I finish each of these lists, you'll figure out what the list is a list of. Watson Brown, Oliver Brown, John Kagi, Dangerfield Newby, John Copeland, Dauphin Thompson, William Thompson, John Brown, Shields Green, John Cook, Edwin Coppock, Jeremiah Anderson, Lewis Leary, Stuart Taylor, Albert Hazlitt, Aaron Stevens, John Anderson, William Lehman. Did everyone kind of guess what that was a list of? The three Browns maybe gave it away. That's a list of the folks who were either killed at Harper's Ferry or captured and hanged thereafter. Approximately 20 people. And here's another list. And this one I know you'll figure out. Herbert Lee, Medgar Evers, Lewis Allen, Andrew Goodman, Michael Schwerner, James Cheney, James Reeb, Viola Liuzzo, Jonathan Daniels, Vernon Dahmer, Samuel Young, Malcolm X, Ben Chester White, Bobby Hutton, Ralph Featherstone, Martin Luther King, Fred Hampton. This is a list of about the same number of people who lost their lives in the 1960s in the interracial struggle for fundamental social change. These lists don't pretend to be complete. Persons whose names have been lost to history, as well as persons simply unknown to me, deserve to be included. But what the lists signify, and the reason that tonight is called In the Shadow of John Brown, or In the Remembrance of John Brown, is that there have been moments when black and white persons acting together risked, and in the case of these 30, 40 individuals, gave their lives to bring about fundamental change. It happened before, it can happen again, it must happen again. We must make it happen again. And my small contribution to that conversation, to that new beginning, will be just to reflect on these two instances of interracial cooperation, the anti-slavery movement led by John Brown, and the portion of the second list that I knew best, the movement for voting rights in the Deep South in the first half of the 1960s. And here you're going to see some difference in emphasis between myself and Mumia. We felt that to make the evening interesting, we needed to dream up certain differences. Because I want to say that the immense and heroic figure of John Brown is not a very helpful model for the kind of new movement we want to create. And there are two problems I will mention that Ms. Fernandez touched on. There is, of course, a debate from time immemorial about the necessity of violence in revolutionary change, or the alternative conception of the late David Dellinger and others of revolutionary nonviolence. But the truth is that although there were circumstances, and the Harper's Ferry raid was one, in which I believe John Brown sought to avoid unnecessary violence, it's also true that in May 1856, Brown, four of his sons, his son-in-law Henry Thompson, took five unarmed men from their homes at night and cut them to pieces with swords. Not just a question of violence, it's a question of violence against unarmed prisoners. And I think that as we go forward in defending the rights of folks at Guantanamo and otherwise, we have to disclaim that kind of violence. I think that Brown is a poor model to us in that regard. A more subtle but equally fundamental issue has to do with how a movement governs itself, how a movement makes decisions. If it is a people's movement, how the leaders of that movement establish accountability to the people, to those whom they presume to lead. John Brown had enormous confidence in his ability to lead a movement to eradicate slavery because he understood his actions to be directed by God. A wife recalled, "My husband always believed that he was to be an instrument in the hands of Providence, and I believed it too. Many a night he lay awake and prayed concerning it." And this was not Laura Bush reflecting on her husband George. This was Mary Brown remembering her husband, John. John Brown himself confirmed what his wife remembered as he lay blood-stained on the floor after his capture, and the governor of Virginia questioned him. Question: "Do you consider this a religious movement?" Answer: "It is, in my opinion, the greatest service man can render to God." Question: "Do you consider yourself an instrument in the hands of Providence?" Answer: "I do." Brown alone wrote the Constitution of the guerrilla republic he hoped to establish in the Allegheny Mountains, adopted without significant discussion at the convention in Chatham, Canada, shortly before the raid. The most exasperating trait exhibited by our current president and his associates is an air of complete certainty, an inability to admit mistakes, a refusal to change course in the face of overwhelming evidence of failure, a state of denial. Even those who most loved and respected John Brown were frustrated by the identical quality in him. And that includes all his sons. These failings foreshadowed both John Brown's insistent advocacy of the Harper's Ferry strategy in the face of objections by Frederick Douglass and others, and the tactical failure to retreat into the Allegheny Mountains during the morning of the Harper's Ferry assault when retreat was still possible, even without the additional arms and ammunition for which Brown waited too long. And so my point is simply that that kind of self-confidence on the part of an individual leader in the correctness of his personal decisions is not something that we should seek to recreate in this new movement of ours. I also want to talk about SNCC, which during the period 1961-64 was likewise an interracial movement. The group that assaulted Harper's Ferry included more than a dozen whites and five or six African Americans, but in SNCC, the principal leaders were always African American males: James Horman, Robert Paris Moses, John Lewis, Julian Bond, later Stokely Carmichael. And with the exception of Bob Zellner, who shared the dangers of organizing in the field with blacks, whites like James Stembridge, Jack Minnis, Casey Hayden, Howard Zinn, and during the summer of 1964, myself, for the most part played supporting technical roles. But I think there was also a problem of centralized leadership in SNCC, which had nothing to do with race, and which I will try briefly to describe without taking up too much of our time. I'm speaking about friends and comrades, many of whom are still alive, but I think Mumia Abu-Jamal has provided a model of how candor and solidarity may be combined in his We Want Freedom, A Life in the Black Panther Party. You recall that the SNCC effort culminated in 1964 with a two-phase strategy. First, the invitation to several hundred whites to come south as voter registrars and freedom school teachers, and then second, the creation of a Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party made up of African Americans who at that time could not vote in the regular Mississippi elections, who would choose Freedom Democratic Party delegates, send them to the Democratic Party National Convention in Atlantic City, and ask that they be seated in place of the all-white regular Mississippi Democrats. That was the Weltanschauung, the scenario of the summer as a whole. And the fact is that both of those decisions were made over the opposition of a majority of SNCC staff. And I'm describing this to you not to single out the good guys from the bad guys, but to describe what I consider an essentially tragic circumstance that in the end raised some of the same problems that we see in different form in John Brown's movement. There was first of all a debate within SNCC as to whether white students, I was a little older, but the age of many of you in this room, should be invited to the summer, for the summer to Mississippi. The argument against it was the following, that SNCC staff, through 3 years of organizing and agitation, had just begun to encourage African Americans in Mississippi to speak up for themselves and begin to take a part in public life, to write leaflets for the first time, often to picket for the first time, and then in the summer to come to their own county and precinct political conventions just as the white folks did. And the feeling of the SNCC staff who focused on this experience was that if this emerging self-articulation, self-government, self-activity of black people was submerged in a flood of articulate white wiseacres from the north, like Staunton, it would have an inhibiting effect on that self-government, which it was the central purpose of SNCC to encourage. The argument on the opposite side was, yeah, but we've been at it for 3 years and very few African Americans have actually been registered. And critically important, the black folk who have been killed during these 3 years were not SNCC staff people. They were Mississippi residents who SNCC staff people had encouraged to become active and visible. That was the argument. And then superimposed on that was a second argument about whether or not it was a good idea to send Freedom Democratic Party delegates to the Democratic Party convention in Atlantic City with the goal of being seated there and taking part in the life of the Democratic Party. A question with some current relevance. And I was present at a meeting in Atlanta in June 1964 when the fact of the matter is that a majority of SNCC staff said, why would we want to be part of the Democratic Party? What's that going to accomplish for us? Is this whole scenario really a good idea? And yet both those decisions went forward, I think it's fair to say, because of the burden felt particularly by SNCC leadership and especially by Bob Moses, who was the lead organizer in Mississippi, as person after person in the black community was killed. There was a critical meeting in Hattiesburg, Mississippi in January or February of 1964 when Bob Moses was called to the phone. The message was this. 3 years before, a man named Herbert Lee in Macomb, a black man, had been shot down in broad daylight by a white representative in the Mississippi State Legislature. And another black man named Lewis Allen had seen the shooting. And the FBI, in its infinite wisdom, had provided protective custody to Mr. Allen, pending a trial, except that it wasn't so protective. because early in 1964, Bob was told on the phone, Lewis Allen has been shot and killed. And Bob left the meeting, he went to Macomb, he talked with Mrs. Allen, he came back and he said, listen, whatever vote we've taken, we got to vote again because we just have to do something different. Invite the white volunteers, go to Atlantic City. It was a totally different kind of centralized leadership than that which John Brown provided at Harper's Ferry, but still it was a centralized leadership, I think. And again, not the model of what we want to create in our own movement. And I'm going to close by saying just a few words about a different model. I think it's fair to say that the new movement in our country had its origin in the Zapatista revolt in Chiapas, Mexico, in January 1994, as the North American Free Trade Agreement was being passed in Congress. And I think we all know that the Zapatistas were opposed to neoliberalism, globalization, imperialism, and that they staged a series of courageous protests against it. But what is perhaps not quite so familiar is that the Zapatistas have developed a point of view which they call mandar obedeciendo, to lead by obeying. And the idea is that, of course, we need leaders. But these leaders need to be responsible to the grassroots, whatever color they are. And an example of what the Zapatistas were talking about came early in 1994 when negotiations began between the Mexican authorities and the Zapatista rebels. And a question arose that hadn't been on the agenda. And the Zapatista participant said, wait, we can't talk about that. We haven't been instructed by our villages. We have to break off the negotiations. We don't care how much inconvenience that causes anyone. We can't proceed just on the basis of what we as delegates think. We have to go back to the assembleas, the assemblies to which we're responsible. And you can see glimmers of this now elsewhere in Latin America, where wonderful things are beginning to happen. When Evo Morales, the indigenous protest leader in Bolivia, was recently elected president, at his inaugural address, he said, "Vamos a gobernar, a mandar, obedeciendo." Now we're going to govern and lead in obedience. Leaders often say things like that. We'll have to see. But my point is a very simple one and may seem to you, to some of you, almost trivial. When we recreate our white and black movement, it can't be a movement built around the charisma of a few leaders, whether they be John Brown or Robert Paris Moses or Mumia Abu-Jamal or any of us in this room. We have to create a movement this time around, I suggest to you, in which the base, the rank and file, the people at the bottom, the local unions in a union situation, the local assembleas, assemblies in civic situations, are ultimately responsible for decisions. if we can do that, black, white, brown, whatever, together, I think we have a real shot this time, and I think we must do it.